Get ready for a week-long celebration of music, community, and fabulous fun with Joy Radiothon 2024. Joy has the largest collection of rainbow podcast content in the world, and you can help keep us out loud and proud by donating during Joy Radiothon 2024. Just go to joy.org.au/radiothon. Mark it in your calendars because Joy Radiothon returns June 1st to 7th. And remember, we all flourish with joy.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
You're on the Escape Pod. This is Mark Adams and Joe Pryor, and we've got a special guest this afternoon, Hayden Lambert. Mark, what's been happening in your week?
Very quiet week. It's been a good week. I've enjoyed it, but not done much, and that was wonderful. But I did get ready to go to Bali for Christmas.
Tell us about the Bali trip.
Yep, booked, paid for, all done, and it's the I've travelled the globe quite extensively, and I've never been to Bali before.
That's a song, isn't it? I've never been to Bali.
Is it?
I think so.
Or is it I've been to Bali too?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. You're right.
Something.
Correct.
It's a cliche. And I'm going to be there with every other Australian family who lives in a McMansion for New Year's.
Mm. How fab.
I know, right? So I'm going to Bali for the first time ever on a bargain vacation holiday, apart from everything's twice the rate as normal.
So whereabouts in Bali are you going to?
We're going to be staying in Seminyak, but we'll be doing lots of things. And I'm going with some old friends who are all single this New Year's. So we've decided to jump a villa and hang the expense. And we're trying to work out what to do for New Year's. So if you've got any ideas about Bali for New Year's, let us know. I really would like some advice. And this is one time where I would like you to advise us what to do. SMS 0427 Joy 949. Phone us in at 1300 Joy 949 and speak to the beautiful Beck, or email us on air at joy.org.au. All Bali New Year's Eve advice is gratefully received. So, wow. Joe, what have you been up to
this week? Well, last night I was in Islay again at a whiskey tasting, which was rather fabulous. I've done non-fiction book club with Hemingway, so I've been to Cuba vicariously. We had the tail end of Fashion Week last Sunday, and it's back to winter. That's where I've travelled to this week. I've travelled back into fur coats. We had that beautiful burst of spring, and it was just a teaser for what's coming.
I know, it was horrible.
Yeah.
To revert back to winter. But we have some brighter things on our horizon, I understand.
We most certainly do. In the studio today, we've got Hayden Lambert. Hayden can talk to us about Belfast. He can talk to us about his desire to keep collecting bartending equipment. And he could probably talk to us for an hour about ice, and that's the ice that goes into your drinks. He's a poet and a blogger. Hayden, welcome to the Escape Pod.
Oh, g'day. How's it going?
Very well indeed. Thank you for coming in.
You guys are saying it's...
Yes.
Yeah, you guys are saying like it's spring. For me, I've been rocking shorts all winter. So I don't get any colder. I just stay the same. I stay the same temperature, you know, coming from Belfast to here.
Like, right.
You know, it was -4 when I was leaving. So at the moment, it's pretty good.
Well, we were hoping today you might tell us a little bit about the history of bartending and why bartenders have to travel.
I think for me personally, I just traveled because I wanted to see the world, and bartending was pretty much the easiest way to do it. So, you know, I jumped on a plane and found that I wasn't very good at anything else. I started chefing a little bit, and that was kind of interesting.
Because some people would join the Navy. I mean, that's what the song says.
Yeah.
Join the Navy and see the world. But you've decided that bartending's the way to do it.
I'm not very good at swimming. So I thought, stay away from the Navy.
And then good decision.
I know. And then you've got to go and do what you're told in other countries instead of just doing what you want to do. You know?
So interesting that you mentioned that. You get to show some creativity in your line of work.
Most certainly.
And then also there's that discipline of the classic cocktail.
Yeah, sure.
How do you interpret that? Do you look at how stern the person is asking? Is it culturally different wherever you go? Do you get to use a bit of wiggle room in interpretation? How do you evaluate that?
Most certainly. There's a lot of wiggle room, especially with classics. I mean, classics tend to be equal proportions of most things.
Hmm.
So I think change in ratios and definitely the culture and you know, the people are really different.
How?
Well, I mean, say for Australia, you guys are quite used to bitter. So, you know, so something like a Negroni, you enjoy quite a lot, where in Northern Ireland, they don't actually like bitter. Bitter is not a flavour that they enjoy. So, like, all of a sudden, you get someone Where in Northern Ireland, I probably sold about 20 Negronis in about 3 months. Mm. Here in Australia, I probably sold about 500 Negronis in 3 months. Mm. So just the different understanding of taste and maybe the palate across those places changes quite widely.
And do you think the palate has changed over time?
I'm really not sure. I think it's what you're exposed to. And I think in Australia, you're exposed to actually quite a lot. You're exposed to, you know, the Asian cultures, you know, the influence of Asian cuisine on food. And then all of a sudden, you know, the Italian culture as well. I mean, you know, so getting Campari, like a lot of people have been exposed to Campari, where in Northern Ireland, you wouldn't have been exposed to Campari. And probably the bitterest.
And yet they're geographically so much closer to Italy than we are.
Oh, most certainly. You know, but the geography has nothing to do with it. It's the population of your culture that makes up what you're associated with and what you get to try. Where in, say, an Italian restaurant in Belfast, they probably only stock a little bit of Campari, but here you get Amaro, you get Campari, you get Crodino, you get all those little things that are so associated with Italy. And you know, you get the chance to try that. And where in Belfast, you probably wouldn't be associated with that at all. You get some deep-fried fish and some beer with a chaser of Smirnoff and Diet Coke.
Did the culture change much? Because your impact on the Belfast scene was quite pronounced and quite strong. You did take a bar, and I think Joe can illustrate this story.
At the Merchant Hotel?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Merchant was really something special. It's a 5-star hotel in Belfast, which was the first of its kind. There were other 5-star hotels, but they're outside the central city. So we were directly in contact with the CBD.
And it's an imposing Georgian building, isn't it?
It's very imposing. And what's cool is there's actually about 5 or 6 buildings like that in the central CBD of Belfast. It was designed by a Scotsman by the name of James Wendt. And he won a competition for, I think it was the Ulster Bank, to design 2 different buildings. So his building, it's all sandstone. And it's really, really nice. And
it would fit in Melbourne, actually,
yeah,
wouldn't it? It's got
it really
that gold
is.
Rush
oh, exactly.
boom
well,
time.
Totally. I think it was 1830 or 1860 was built. So it has that really beautiful monolithic look to it, and it incorporates all the beautiful things that you would associate with a grand bank at the time. And, you know, I worked there as a principal primary bartender from the day we opened. So I think my impact is... Oh, I don't know. I wouldn't say it's huge, but it was an awesome place and an awesome time to be there. It was a time of prosperity for Northern Ireland. So all of a sudden you have something that's been a little bit left behind and hasn't caught up, and it started catching up, and you start making these wonderful drinks and start selling wonderful products to people. And then it became a popular destination and a go-to bar, and then we won award after award. And you know, I think it's just turn up every day and making sure you have a good time and you present that good time to everybody. You know, it's the same what I do down at Bar Americano.
Which is where you are here in Melbourne.
Exactly. Little Bar Americano.
Yes, it's probably the world's tiniest bar.
Nearly.
So back to Belfast. What inspired you with regards to creating the drink list?
Well, I mean, the great thing about being in Belfast is I was under the stewardship of Sean Muldoon. And Sean Muldoon is quite an inspiring guy. We have very, very different ideas now that we've grown up and we've moved on. But, you know, when all of a sudden he comes to you and he goes to, in the context, we're going to do classic-style drinks and we're going to put a little bit of improvisation on them. And it's really simple twists on classic drinks. So we were pretty standard classic drink bar, you know, martinis and Negronis, old fashions. And then we had our own signatures and we kind of reinvented our own Mai Tai. And, you know, with that, the contribution isn't always, you know, do we sit down and we work out the flavors and all that kind of stuff? It's as you go along. Do we need more sour? Do we need less sour? Do we need more sweet? And, you know, do we need to make our drinks drier? So after the first year of trading, we realized that we had an audience and we could teach the audience. So the direction that we pushed our menu in is basically the direction we took our customers. And it's that kind of same no holds bar. There's no compromise. This is what we do and this is how we do it. If you're interested in coming to enjoy what we do, then come and enjoy it. And I think that's the kind of the party line we took in the bar.
It's almost like the soup Nazi out of Seinfeld.
Soup Nazi. I haven't watched Seinfeld in years.
So what was the rigor like in Belfast for cocktail bars? Was there much of the culture there, or was the drinking culture different and this was a new thing on the horizon?
Pretty much, you know, like as I said before with Sean Muldoon. Sean Muldoon pretty much opened every cocktail bar in Belfast. And they all closed. So they started up. There was a time when people were like, oh, yeah, we really need cocktails. And when I'm talking about cocktails, I'm high street cocktails, simple mojitos, and then you're like raspberry Collins and all that kind of stuff. So like all of a sudden Sean was implementing those bars. They were working for 4 or 5 months when people were interested, the staff were trained, and then as soon as a staff member disappeared or left to go to another bar, they kind of fell by the wayside. So in retrospect, it's kind of, the Merchant Hotel was the first bar that actively put a lot of money into containing a cocktail bar.
Right, and you know, it had some level of stickiness that people
exactly,
kept coming back.
Exactly, it stuck, and it's still going strong. You know, it's been open now 7 years.
What a great feather in your cap to have been a part of that.
Oh, it was awesome. You know, you don't see it at the time. Sometimes you just see the trees. But, you know, when you step out of it, you look at it and go, I really, really enjoyed my time in that hotel. Mm. A 5-star boutique hotel, one of the world's most awarded cocktail bars. You know, at the time we were competing against all the Mayfair bars. So the Connaught, the Langham, you know, on top of that, then you've got Ritz.
And they're the bars that are located in London.
Yeah, and they're our competition, and that's the hard thing. And at the same time, you're trying to maintain the fact that your direct competition is Belfast, but when you eclipse it, and, you know, it's like having a Michelin star restaurant go up against a bistro. You know, bistro is lovely.
Right.
Yeah, but you'd love to eat in a Michelin star
market,
restaurant.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's maybe it sounds a little bit cocky to say that, but...
No, but you can't expect Knightsbridge in Belfast.
Yeah, exactly. That's the hard thing. So you can't expect Knightsbridge, but you can bring that same kind of friendliness, and you can bring a different attitude. And Belfast is like that. It's not sticky like or snooty like London.
So how is the Belfast scene when it comes to the cocktails and...
Yeah, there's cocktail bars, and I hope the Belfast, or that Merchant Hotel, was a beacon for everyone. Say, hey, we can actually do it. Because everyone told us we couldn't do it. Within the first 3 months of opening, we were told that we'd be closed within 6 or 7 months.
Mm.
You know, and then 6 years on and awards and, you know, great press and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it just goes to show that if you stick at something and you don't take the high ground, but your compromise is limited, that you can achieve whatever you want.
What a thrill to have been a part of that.
Well, before we leave Belfast... and move on to another topic. I did want to ask, can you tell us a bit about the expensive cocktail?
Oh, the world's most expensive cocktail.
Yes.
That was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun because I sold two of them myself.
How much were they?
£750, which at the time was 1,145 euros.
My goodness. And what was the cocktail?
The cocktail was a simple Mai Tai. And the great thing about the Mai Tai is, you know, it's recognised throughout the world as one of the most phenomenal tiki drinks. Quite simply, rum, a little bit of curacao, lime juice, orgeat. And we picked it up, and we picked it up because we got given a bottle of Ray and Nephew's 17-year-old rum, which was pretty rare at the time.
And why was that rum just so rare? I mean, 17-year-old rum doesn't sound that rare to me.
No, it's rum because of the style. It's single pot still, which hadn't been produced probably from the 1920s. And there's some debate about the history of where that rum come from, or came from, sorry, come from. It's New Zealand language coming in there. And so, like, you know, the rum comes from... an era where single pot still was drunken quite a lot. And then the need for a kind of lighter, less full-bodied, less heavier rum came about. And you know, it was cool just to get our hands on it. I think we stole it at first, and then we decided to sell it, which made Appleton, Ray and Nephew, quite unhappy. But, you know...
So were you expecting to sell more than one?
Well, trying to get people to part with £750 for a drink is pretty difficult, you know. I managed to sell two. The other guys, we sold 13 altogether.
That's not bad.
That's not bad, yeah. £750, that's pretty good. That's my mortgage.
And you obviously had a couple of sips to make sure that the cocktail was perfectly balanced.
Yeah,
so was it worth £750?
You have to be a lover of cocktails to enjoy that thing. Your value. Yeah, oh, totally. It sounds
diplomatic way of putting it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's like everyone.
Not lover of having pounds in your pocket.
Exactly. You know, like for me, that was a mortgage on my house. It's exactly my mortgage, £750. So, you know, for some people that £750 was the equivalent of £775. The value is just dependent, you know. I think we talked about it the other night. You get a pair of shoes for £2,000.
You know, yes, it's all relative.
It's all relative to how much money you make and what you like.
Mm.
You know, so for some people it was an acquiring a history. It's that one-upmanship that you can never have it with anyone else, or you've had it and they can't have it. For some people it's the fact that they like the Mai Tai and they like the exclusive history, because there's a huge argument between Don the Beachcomber versus Trader Vic about who created the Mai Tai. So it's an interesting twist in our cocktail history anyway.
And in terms of creating cocktails of that calibre, does that then lead into things like the bar and cocktail competitions that have become so prevalent now that they're moving out of just the industry knowing about them, that the general public gets involved?
The whole world knows about them, yeah. It's crazy because it's probably for the companies, it's one of the best marketing tools you could ever have. You know, you gain, when you sign up to a cocktail competition, you sign over all creative control and license to the actual companies.
My goodness. And in return, though, there's usually travel involved, isn't there, as a prize?
There's a lot of travel. There's a lot of travel. There's a lot of drinking. There's a lot of fun. You know, we're bartenders and we have an alternative lifestyle. You know, when you guys are awake during the daytime, we're sleeping. And when you're sleeping, we're partying and making great drinks, hopefully. And so, you know, those kind of competitions, one, get you thinking about what you want to do for that brand. They get you involved in that brand. They get you to not buy in, but you actually look at it in depth and you research that brand. And then you come and sell that brand to everybody else because you're selling part of yourself. You know, it's your creation.
So you become a brand ambassador
a mini brand ambassador. You know, like I did Bacardi Legacy and I did the 42 Below cocktail competition.
And so Bacardi is obviously a rum-based competition,
exactly.
And 42 Below would have been a vodka.
Vodka for New Zealand. Mm. Yeah. Unusual that I was the New Zealand captain of the English team.
Using a
Kiwi
product.
The first time I flew home to New Zealand in 6 years. Thank you very much, 42 Below.
Yeah, they make a very good product. And Joy, by the way, just so everyone is very clear, Joy endorses the responsible consumption of alcohol.
Oh, I endorse it as well, as much as I can.
Yeah, very good. So when you're going to these shows, they must rely on marketing and what their marketing message is and who they're communicating to. So the markets all around the world are quite different.
Exactly.
So you've got to be on brand and you've got to be there to make sure you're delivering a message through a channel that's going to be received by the consumer, because it's all about promoting and marketing, and which is great. I mean, Santa got a red costume by Coke and that's all.
Exactly.
You know, and business is part of our culture. So
for sure.
Understand that. What are other cultural influences that may be from TV programming like Mad Men or Boardwalk Empire or Sex and the City that have changed the way people view, consume, buy, appreciate?
Sex and the City was great in the 90s. That really got people back into drinking martinis.
Mm.
And it got, you know, cosmopolitans. And, you know, I think I mentioned to you a few times, I love making a cosmopolitan. Unfortunately, I don't make one at Bar Americano, but it was one of my favourite drinks to make.
Why is that?
I think it's, I don't know. I think it was the fact that at the Merchant Hotel, no matter what you tried to sell and how, you know, how much you love classic drinks, everyone still ordered Cosmopolitan. So for me, it was one of those drinks that I didn't feel complete like I'd actually worked without making one.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was one of my starting drinks. And it's one of those things when you make what you think is a drink very well and you can make it quickly and efficiently, and you see the joy that, for me, a lot of the time, it's the joy that sharing cocktails actually brings to a table.
Right.
You know, and you see people tasting it, and it's like food. You know, you don't see people sharing beer, you know, which is quite funny. You know, a lot of, it's only if you're going to try a new beer that you'll share it. You know, but generally men hold on to their pints or their pots or whatever you have, and they won't share. But at a table with cocktails, people all share. And that's that kind of celebration, which I think drinking has lost its little connotation to. It's a celebration. It used to celebrate a lot of different things, births, deaths, you know, like anniversaries, and now it's become just what we do.
So globally, when you're travelling around, do you see difference in the ritual of drinking and how people go to, like, a cocktail bar is somewhere that people make a conscientious decision to spend a little bit more on their drinks because they're getting something that's handmade or spoke. It's not just opened or poured and handed over on a piece of towel. It's something that is going to be made according to what they want.
Exactly.
And it's going to be premium liquor usually, so it's going to be higher price point, and it's a time consuming thing to do.
Of course.
So you pay for all those privileges. So already people have made a change in their, made a decision in what they're going to do when they go into a cocktail bar.
Sure.
How does that change around the world? You mentioned before about the bitter.
Yeah, I think that the context of drinking doesn't change too much. Like we all drink, whether, you know, especially English style culture. We drink in New Zealand, you guys drink in Australia. We all celebrate the same things.
Mm.
We all have the same kind of influence.
Mm.
France, Italy, then you get into the Slovakian countries. They change a little bit, you know. They're pension for different things. But I think everyone follows the same thing. We like dinner, we have drinks, it's a get-together. The flavours change all the time, you know, the different styles. Like, if you're in Japan, Japan cocktails are slightly different.
How is that?
Well, their palate's different, you know. Like, I think there was... I haven't been to Japan. I've been to Japan once, and it was very, very quick. But even when we follow the style of cocktail bartending, we know that their sour is different. They're not. They don't enjoy sour like we enjoy sour.
I'm thinking in my mind of the Suntory range,
sure, exactly.
And I'm thinking of Midori and Lina and strawberry, and so sweeter.
It's a little bit sweeter, and they do like those kind of flavors, you know. And I'm sure that that's everywhere. And then there's some people, you know, it does depend on where you are. Spain enjoys gin and tonic. They're the largest consumers of gin in the world. The Spanish,
okay.
And they don't drink it like we drink it. You know, we have a couple cubes of ice, a slice of lemon. There's a whole ritual to making a gin and tonic in Spain.
It blew me away
it's
recently.
A large glass.
How different?
Well, I mean, we take for granted that a gin and tonic's two pieces of ice, some gin, some tonic, and a lemon, as I said. Theirs is a, how can I make this the most phenomenal gin and tonic I can ever drink?
Yeah, and so, they match the gins to the tonic water.
Yeah, plus, and the botanicals. So not only are they only just giving you ice, they're giving you ice. And then they're adding on top of that different botanicals that were within the gin. So extra juniper, more citrus.
Oh.
And then they're serving it to you in a balloon-style glass or a large wine glass. So you're going to fully appreciate the aromas that the evaporation or the bubbles pop from the tonic give to your nose. So all of a sudden it becomes more than just a drink. It becomes a ritual, and you're like, if you go and have that gin and tonic anywhere else in the world, you're very disappointed.
I feel suddenly naked in front of my gin and tonic.
Yeah, I know, don't you, just?
Housekeeping done.
Yeah, we're all tidy and spick and span.
We are.
Believe you.
Time to put the dust coat back, Joe.
It's such a lovely dust coat, isn't it? It's like,
yes.
It's got to be fur.
You gentlemen know me too well.
Too well.
Talking about fur, I'm going straight to Sex and the City again, and people can interpret that however they wish.
I was about to say, what type of fur are we talking about, Sex and the City?
You were mentioning that because of the popularity of the show and the cocktails they were drinking, they became very popular, and that was a good thing for cocktails.
Oh, it's a great
as,
thing.
As scornful as some people might be of it now, because it is, as you said, so old and dated.
But even Tom Cruise and Top Gun was great for the industry as well.
So what about Boardwalk Empire and Mad Men? Have they both...
Well, for me, they're phenomenal because that's kind of up our alley at Bar Americano and the Merchant Hotel. It's brought the kind of... I don't know. The two characters, like Nucky Thompson and Don Draper, two phenomenally bad characters. And, you know, everyone likes a bad boy. And they kind of represent when they're pulling old fashions and drinking all sorts of lovely drinks. So it's given men an excuse to drink cocktails again, where Sex and the City is more orientated around cosmos and slightly lighter, more, I hate to say girly drinks, but definitely more girly drinks.
Well, targeted very much like women, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a horrible statement, because technically men were the co-founders and creators of most cocktails, because, you know, women weren't allowed saloons and bars a long time ago. So, you know, girly for me is... doesn't exist. You know, a pink cocktail is just as much as a man's drink as it is a woman's drink. And so seeing things like the old fashions and the amount of booze that's on portrayal in Mad Men is phenomenal, because that gets people thinking about, oh, actually I will try an old fashioned. And then that gives them a chance, well, if I like an old fashioned, then maybe I like straight whiskey. And then, you know, we're getting away from the kind of craze of Alco Pops and Bacardi Breezes and Cruises and all those types of things. So it's really good to see that the palate's starting to develop. And instead of being adolescent, we're getting into a much more grown-up stage.
And do you think when people present to the bar and they order, for example, they're channeling Don Draper and they want a Gibson instead of a martini, can you see that look in their eye? Is that...
Yeah, this is slightly sexy confidence, isn't there? You know, when you know what you want, and the only way you can have it is the way you want it. You know, but there's also that thing that maybe they've misinterpreted what Don Draper actually wants. And, you know, they don't know what a martini is. And then there's that kind of scary confusion. They've just been landed a drink that, you know, for them is unpalatable, undrinkable. Mm. And no matter how much dissuasion or how much you try to persuade them from trying something slightly different to get them acclimatized to that style of drink, they'll still go, no, I'll have it, I've heard it. And especially it's great when you see young women come and order martinis, but it's horrible to see them not drink it. You know, there's that confidence that they've seen it, they want it, you know, they're emulating their favourite character, and that's really, really nice as well. And then you get on to like Nucky Thompson. Nucky Thompson in Boardwalk Empire isn't so much a cocktail guy, he's just a straight whiskey drinker.
Yeah.
And then that gives you more in depth. People are more interested in learning about American Prohibition. And I mean, the great confusion between Prohibition and what we do at Bar Americano is that we're not a Prohibition bar or a speakeasy. We're an American bar, and American bars have been around for 200 years.
But aren't you more of a Cuban?
No, star? That's Bar Economico out in Richmond. That's a Latin rum bar. Now, Bar Americano is a small alleyway bar, so that's hidden. But I mean, it's not hidden on purpose. It's just the fact that it's a nice space down an alleyway. It's not.
But that's Melbourne style bars, right?
Exactly.
And
you know,
find you.
Yeah.
Definitely find you.
Oh, well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Melbourne people have GPS like pigeons.
Yeah,
oh,
it's great when you know. It's great when you hear a Melburnian, if that's the term, a Melburnian.
Yes, we are
Melburnians. Melburnians like Wellingtonians, and yeah, so Melburnian go. I know. I never knew this was here. And you're like, yeah, but everyone else did. Mm. Yeah. Catch up.
Catch up, guy. Squeeze the tomato. Catch up.
Exactly.
So, what makes Melbourne unique with
for
the
me,
drink
you guys
compared
have,
to other places?
You have a phenomenal culture of these little alleyways and laneways, which is, to me, it's reminiscent of Greece and Rome, and especially Rome. I spent a lot of time in Rome. So, for me, it's kind of like when I walk down an alleyway, it's not as bright or as intense. But it's like it has that pocket of I'm just going to stumble around, and I sometimes walk to work thinking I'm going to stumble around the corner and see the Pantheon, and you know I know it's not there. It's the imagery
the
of I have in my head. You know I'm going to stumble across the Pantheon and then I'm going to double back onto the Trevi Fountain, and you know that to me is very reminiscent of where I spent my kind of university years, or where I should have been spending my university years.
And was that tending bar?
I was tending bar in Italy, yeah. I spent a lot of time there. It wasn't as good as what I'm working in now, but you've got to start somewhere. So my bar was pretty much disregard all responsible service of alcohol and just enjoy the moment, and that was cool. So it gave me the opportunity while I worked in Italy to refine talking and having a fun time.
Do you think that Australia has become very rigid in the responsible serving of alcohol? Because after moving back from Dubai, mm-hmm. I was quite shocked at how a conservative Middle Eastern, predominantly Muslim country with strong social ideas of alcohol and alcohol consumption was so much more loosey-goosey than Melbourne. Came back to Melbourne, and the first bar I went into, I remember seeing people who looked a little bit tipsy getting cut off, and then ask again and you're out. And it was that black and white. And I never saw that in Dubai.
Yeah, I think the problem was all of a sudden the responsibility for humans has fallen across me, the bartender. Hmm. So I all of a sudden become responsible for your actions. And, you know, if you go out and drive a car, then I can be held responsible for that. That makes me nervous, because I don't want that to happen. I don't want to be responsible.
I don't understand how that works, because you can't control what people drink when they walk away from the bar.
For sure, I can control what you drink with me, and I'll look after you to the best of my ability. But I know you're coming to me to drink alcohol. Like, a chef will keep serving you food even though you're full. So, you know, like, I do my best, and I'm pretty good. I look after people, and I try not to send them on anywhere else. Mm. And if you're hanging around with me until 1 o'clock, then I know you're not going anywhere else. And I know, I understand what my drinks are capable of. But, I mean, at the same time, it's difficult. You're trying to uphold two things. I think it's more of a kind of nanny, like, this hurts our economy and this hurts our city. And I think it's maybe the understanding of alcohol from an early age opposed to enforcing it and trying to be, you know, a little bit, what's the word I'm looking for?
It's almost a puritanical response, isn't it?
To me, it's a little bit zealous.
But
and
you're
religious.
A city-based bar now, right in the heart of Melbourne. So I guess that affects the nights that you're busy as well, compared to somewhere like Chapel Street, which is 7 days a week.
Oh, for sure. Plus the size of our space limits the actual style of drinking you can have and cost as well.
Mm. And dwarf tossing, you probably have very little of that.
But what?
Dwarf tossing.
There's
dwarf
no Cuba. Room to swing a cat, leave alone a dwarf.
Yeah, no one's tried to pick me up behind the bar and throw me. So,
or set you on fire, don't go to a St Kilda
exactly.
game.
Exactly. You know, if that happens up in St Kilda or Chapel Street, I should hit up there and see what's going on.
Might make a few bucks.
Exactly. I get a fireproof suit. No, I think sometimes we are a little bit silly with it. We don't talk about it. I think a lot of people in general understand the effect of other drugs opposed to the effect of alcohol on their system.
And how does that mentality compare to Italy or Northern Ireland?
Well, Northern Ireland, they're born drinking. They wake up and go to the pub, and that's pretty much it. They have a high problem with alcohol. Like most countries have a high problem with alcohol. Italy, Italians are strange. They drink a lot of wine, and they can drink a lot. I think they drink differently. It's different. It's at the dinner table when you're young. And
it's a lower alcohol content too, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a lower alcohol. It's like the French. You know, a lot of people always talk about the French enjoying a glass of wine with their dinner. And then you go, the Italians would be the same. And then there's the availability of it in cafes and everywhere. So you're always surrounded by it. It's not something that you can't touch and look at it until you get to an age of 18 or 19. And so by the time you get to 18, 19, it's not, let's go party. It's like, oh, I've already been doing this. I've already enjoyed a glass of wine. I can take it a little bit further. I'll have a few drinks. We'll have a party with our friends. And I think it's just a different... They have a better respect for what alcohol actually does because they deal with it so much earlier on. Not to say I want to see all the kids out drinking at an early age.
No, but I was raised with a very German mentality that we're not from 13.
Sure, Germany's the same. And Austria is the same.
Yeah,
you can drink at 16 and
fish,
then...
Fish, white wine.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Small. It's not that you want to get everyone drunk. But we have this, no, alcohol is this bad, bad product, and yet it's one of the most highly taxed products, and it's one of the most available products. So, we have this kind of...
It's a dichotomy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really, really strange.
You're in the Escape Pod with Mark Adams, Joe Pryor, and our special guest, Hayden Lambert. So, Hayden, we've had a really wide-ranging conversation this afternoon, so thank you again for being our special guest.
That's normally how we go, isn't it?
It is. It's why you're one of my favourite bartenders, absolutely. So what's the favourite place that you like to visit?
Me, it would definitely have to be Rome. Rome would be one of my favourite places.
And what are your tips for visiting Rome?
Yeah, just really enjoy it. Try and do as much as you can, but take the time to just sit still and watch the city pass you by. And I'll go back to the Pantheon comment. The Pantheon's probably one of the greatest places just to sit and watch people disappear and turn up and tourists and just people watch. I love it. I think it's one of the best cities in the world to get lost, walk down an alleyway. It's not too scary. It's not too... it's quite safe at night to walk around, I think. You know, I buzzed around Rome at 3 or 4 in the morning and never had a problem. Stay away from the tourist places to eat. Go and eat in places, even if they don't look accommodating. You know, I think I remember seeing a tourist sign, "We don't serve a tourist menu here." And I was like, "Can we go and eat there?" And like, my wife's like, "Nah, it's no tourist menu." I'm like, "But that's a good thing. That's not a bad
Absolutely.
Thing.
Absolutely.
It's a great thing. You know, who wants penny arrabbiata all the time?"
On yeah, exactly. Anything that's in a lean cuisine,
exactly.
You probably don't want when you're in Italy. When you are in a place like Rome, what cocktail would you order that epitomises the experience for you? And then what other places have the same kind of...
Oh, sure. For Rome, for me, is Negroni time. Negroni with probably 3 beer chaser and something else. But the great thing about Negroni is that it's always served by someone who's grumpy and doesn't want to make it for you. And
is that so?
Yeah, it's like Italian culture is fun. You know, there's a lot of older gentlemen working behind bars and they still have that, it's a profession. And so the gentleman's normally like, oh, you know, I have to make this Negroni, he makes espresso, he makes cappuccinos, and then all of a sudden some foreigner walks in and asks for a Negroni. And they kind of give you a very dismissive look and pour you the largest drink you've ever had. It's almost like, yeah, hey, drink that. And it kills me.
Like a litre of Negroni
just to
shut you up.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, 2 litres.
And there are some bartenders who are notoriously grumpy. It can be a night's entertainment to try to get them to smile.
Is there
any universal etiquette that you would like to share with everyone who's listening this afternoon about how to approach a cocktail bar and how to speak with your bartender?
In English, generally. That helps. Sometimes use small words, sometimes use big words depending on who we are. Little ones help me all the time. I'm not a mind reader, so, you know, even though I do my best to read all the signals, help me out and actually tell me what you'd like and what you want.
So be honest?
Yeah, be honest. I think honesty is a huge thing in a bar. If you don't like something or you do like something, then you can form a really good relationship. You know, like Joe, when you come in and I ask if you like a drink, I'm waiting for an honest response. If you give me a dishonest response, then I can't fix your night. You're going to walk away and tell everybody that you had terrible drinks. But the fact of the matter is that you didn't have the maturity or the foresight to say, actually, I didn't like that. And be honest with us. We can fix something so you actually have a good time instead of a bad cocktail experience. Yeah. I think that's one of the major issues is that people always talk about cocktails in a negative light, because when they had a bad cocktail experience, they didn't try and rectify it. In a restaurant, if you have a bad plate of food, you'll send it back. Mm. Well, in general, you'll send it back. And the restaurant will do their darndest to make sure that you get a great plate of food. And if they don't, then you'll boycott them forever. So for me, I think it's just being honest, and honest that you like, you know, you like certain things. I think for most people, learn the difference between sweet, sour, bitter. And, you know, that's really important to know. Sweet and bitter are two different things. Sweet and bitter, or sour and bitter, are two different tastes. And just try and not gain that vocabulary, but look into what is sweet and what is bitter. Because when I'm trying to interpret what bitter is for you, you're thinking sour. And then I'm going to deliver a really, right. really bad drink for you. So those little things. Drink orders, you know, just be polite. You know, if you come in and you're rude to me, I don't know what you expect. If I came into your place of work and I was rude to you, what would I expect? Mm. You know, it's a little bit of tit for tat. That's really easy etiquette. Mm. Be polite. If you had too much to drink and I talk around it in a nice way, then accept it, you know.
Okay, fair enough. And do you find that...
tip. We like tips.
Well, is tipping culture different around the world?
Oh, always, everywhere.
I know the United States is very...
Yeah, well, tipping in the States is almost mandatory, so you may as well just start handing over the money, whether you've had good service or bad service.
Mm. Yeah, and it's about a dollar a drink from my experience in the States.
I mean, some people in the States expect up to 15 to 20%. Like, I got one of the greatest gifts while I was traveling through the States as a young man was a tip card. And every time I ordered, I just checked my tip card as the recommended amount of money I should leave for the food and beverage, and it was awesome. I never over-tipped, I never under-tipped. Mm. And that was the best thing anyone gave me, because all of a sudden, you know, you're in a culture that expects tipping, and you don't tip, and then you wonder why you don't get any service.
And what do you think people are expecting here in Melbourne?
I think Melbourne's pretty good. I think a lot of people travelled in Australia, so it's good to see that when you're outside Australia that there is tipping culture. Mm. In hospitality, I think people under the mentality that you get paid good money for your job, so why should I tip? Mm. But I mean, tipping's not like that. Tipping's, it's an appreciation. Mm. And I never expect it, and I'm always very, very grateful for it.
Mm. I think you're right. Nobody expects a tip. They're grateful when they get one.
And we're very grateful.
Very expensive to go out here.
Yeah, of course.
And that's wages are part of that expense.
Yeah, lobby your government to change your taxes.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that we want people to earn less.
Exactly. We want everyone to earn
a tip is a lovely thing to give. And every time I've given a tip, it's because someone has given me not just a drink, but an experience.
Yeah,
that bit of experience in theatre and that human connection is worth recognising with a consideration.
We go to bars to be social.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the drinking's a part of that socialness. But, I mean, with a tip, it's always some people tip, some people don't. You know, if you're willing to tip, we're always very, very grateful. Mm. And I know Kevin and I in the bar, we always try to thank everybody personally. Mm. If you leave any money, because it's the same for us, we know exactly what that money contributes to. Mm. And there's no expectations. I never expect anyone to do anything like that. Mm. But if you're in a culture where it's tip, you know, you're in their culture, you're not in your own culture.
Exactly.
And so when you go to those countries, you know, you have to behave in the way that those people behave. And you'd expect the same when someone came to your own country.
Yeah, yeah, fair enough.
I always tip.
Do you?
I do.
Don't run with scissors. I think to me. So harsh.
I think it's really important when someone's crafted a cocktail uniquely for you, from scratch, and sometimes that even involves reshaping an ice cube and finding the right glassware and really taking time. And it's not just the product that's created. Often it's the conversation that happens. I mean, you know, some people have a great therapist and some people like to see their bartender once a week.
Yeah, I'm much cheaper. Yeah. And I'm probably more honest, you know, because I don't need you to keep coming back. I like you coming back, but, you know, I don't cover the same topic twice. I don't
know. No, and we couldn't fit a therapist's sofa in Bar Americano anyway.
It'd be fun, you know. Everyone have to sit around and listen. It could be good.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
This podcast was produced by Joy Media. You can support Joy's diverse sound and diverse community this June by donating to Joy Radiothon 2024. Go to joy.org.au/radiothon. And remember, we all flourish with joy.